is no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast on the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Reading all this fucking hullabaloo. Manhattan Project this, Robert Oppenheimer that, you know. I'm thinking, if this was the Queen's project, that'd be nice.
What do you mean?
Because they would just be trying
to make the ultimate
non-greasy Zeppeli. idea of like a Zeppeli that has the powdered sugar on it, sure, but it doesn't always go up into your beard or your mouth.
Wait, you talking about the British royalty, the Queen?
No, he's talking about like Lafrac City.
No, my town.
Yeah. You're talking about Queens.
Yeah, Woodhaven.
Yeah, Lafrac.
Yeah, I'm talking about Ozone Park.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're making, so this is a pun.
I am just saying, no, I don't know if it's a pun. I just don't know.
The Manhattan Project, but you want to call it the Queens Project, and then you're going to talk about how Queens people are fat.
I think, we're Italian American. And then Haitian American. I mean, it's a real melting pot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just the idea, going to a Zeppelin.
Well,
have you ever had a Zeppelin, a good Zeppelin?
Never.
Yeah, of course.
You have, Marcus.
You've definitely never had a Zeppelin.
Is it a funnel cake? Is it just a funnel cake by a different name?
No, it's a Zeppelin.
I'm sure you've had it. You've got a sweet tooth.
Have you ever had sausages and peppers for like a proper stand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to like a San Gennaro's? Remember the San Gennaro's Festival? I'm starving.
What's happening?
I'm starving.
Yeah, I remember San Gennaro's Festival. I've been. Yeah.
Yeah. Queens, we used to do that. Every fucking week we used to go. We used to have a bouncy castle for all the fat men to go stare and watch the kids. They'd smoke cigars and then be like, don't break your fucking leg. And it's all they do. That was the
wrap it up.
Oh, what is it? What's the Manhattan Project?
It's the Queens Project.
Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. Ben hanging out with Marcus.
I'm sitting here. All I do is read.
Hungry Henry.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Not a problem. Okay, we are on to part four of the Manhattan Project.
Don't worry. This one's just as long as the last three.
And if it was the Queen's Project, I mean... Yeah.
It was a... Right.
I just thought you were talking about the Queen.
I just needed to center my thoughts on a single bit.
Here we go. We've got it.
So when we last left the Manhattan Project, the espionage wing had successfully captured every member of the German team that had failed to produce an atomic bomb for the Nazis.
The Pokémensch!
These men were the infamous Uranium Club, and American forces had been successful in keeping them all out of Soviet hands.
Good work, boy!
Yeah. Nice job!
But when it comes to the science wing of the Manhattan Project, the main show... We've got to turn the hands on our World War II clock back about 6 months before the official defeat of the Nazis.
You're talking about a clock that reflects years instead of the daily time, though.
Well,
so
months.
You mean more like, I do think a calendar. It's like, we'll set the calendar pages back. I want to make sure I'm sandbagging the show this week.
Yeah.
To make sure we really get to the center of our analogies.
Turn the pages back on the calendar 6 months.
You'll really understand how difficult it is to sandbag a whole show.
Well, we don't only have to turn back the calendar. We got to leave Europe altogether and refocus our series on Los Alamos in New Mexico, where the bomb was being built, and the Pacific Theater of World War II, where the path for the bomb was being paved, so to speak. Now, if you'll remember, the Manhattan Project had two sites producing fuel for two different types of atomic bombs, because General Leslie Groves had gone with a scattershot approach to make sure we hit our target of developing a bomb before the Nazis did.
Or maybe it was because he knew, according to some sources I have collected, that he knew that the trigger bomb would never work, and they had to find a new way to fake a bomb. Work all the way up to a fake testing site in order to fake the bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because it's so much easier to fake a giant international incident of war that changes the face of the planet and the history than to just do it.
Big if true. Big if true.
I read a book that I'm deeply triggered by.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Well, out of the site at Oak Ridge in Tennessee, you had uranium. The stuff enriched there had taken a long road from the uranium mines of the Belgian Congo to Nazi Germany.
And was it like a road trip? Was it fun?
Yeah, it was a road trip. A dog licked some peanut butter off of somebody's genitals on the way.
Whoa,
it was really fun.
What kind of road trip have you been on? My goodness gracious. I was thinking more a skinny guy had sex with a larger lady and everyone laughed.
I remember everyone like, they can't. They won't be together. That's an odd couple. They'd never choose. But that's sometimes strange. They do.
Yeah, sometimes they do.
Well, this is the uranium that Boris Pasch had stolen from the Soviets immediately after Germany's surrender. And that uranium would be used in the Little Boy bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
It's kind of crazy that I'm both Little Boy and Fat Man.
Isn't that nice? That's why you're an actor.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm the Thin Man, which is the prototype bomb. What's Ben?
Oh, I'm just the plane. Yes, easy.
Ben 29.
Ben, a.k.a. Enola Gay. That's you.
Enola Gay?
That was the name of the plane.
All right. Only during Mardi Gras.
Well, Hanford site in Washington State, though, that was producing plutonium. Straight up American stuff that would be used in a bomb called Fat Man that would annihilate the city of Nagasaki.
Man, making of the atomic bomb, I forgot just how fucking huge the Hanford site was and what they did. They built it's the size of an inside, like in the Empire State Building, but it's on its side and it's a uranium / plutonium enriching factory. It's insane.
I have no problem with what the bomb did, killing all those people. Okay, but let's get correct here. It's a person of weight, a person pre-gout, a person who has diabetes.
Well, the stuff from Hanford site, that would also be the stuff used in the very first nuclear explosion in history, the Trinity test. Now, by March of 1944, both sites had produced enough nuclear material for 3 bombs, 2 to drop and 1 to test.
Which is 1 to lick. That's my bomb.
The scientists at Los Alamos had also produced 2 mechanisms for detonating the different materials, the gun method and the implosion method, both of which are far too complicated for us to explain.
Here, I'll try.
Okay.
The gun method's all about slapping shit together.
Okay.
It's slapping. Like, you know, I sometimes will, like, I'll have one piece of roast beef, and I'm like, that's not enough.
Yeah.
And I put another slice on there, right? Because I like to just eat a free hand.
Yeah,
I don't make
of course.
I don't spend time making sandwiches.
Bad.
Sure, right, absolutely. Right? Technically, that's what bodybuilders do.
That look at me. All absolutely. I'm doing is building my body.
Absolutely.
And that's how you do. You slap them together, right? You shoot one bead of uranium at another one, and it makes a boom boom, right? And the other one is a circle of explosions around a piece of whatever it is, the built up plutonium, whatever it is. And
uranium.
Uranium.
Oh, man, already. We shouldn't be complex. I shouldn't be trying to
do
this.
No, you got it. You got
but
it.
It explodes.
Three sentences.
It explodes in a circle in a perfect dodecahedron,
right,
which is also the symbolic actual entity of the 3D version of the universe, which is why when J. Robert Oppenheimer blew up the second bomb that used the implosion technique, that's what ripped open the fucking veil that allowed the aliens to come through and look at us.
All right.
Because it was a symbolic gesture. So Aleister Crowley gets in there as well.
Okay. Well, very powerful.
Well, you are correct in that it was a plutonium bomb, now that I'm thinking about it. The implosion method was the plutonium method. However, the second bomb dropped was a uranium bomb that was used with the trigger method. So therefore, your argument is null and void.
I'm trying to understand the
You're
science.
Doing great. It's kind of like a species reveal for the aliens as well.
But the explosions around the bomb create a little, it squishes the material, then it blows up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like that.
Perfect. Nailed it.
But incredibly, the gamble of General Groves, the scattershot gamble, it paid off double. As it turned out, both plutonium and uranium were viable for weaponization.
Yay.
It's like they want us to kill the Japanese.
It was like they wanted us to kill the Nazis, but then they finished up too quick. And I'm sorry to my wife for that as well.
Yeah. Additionally, the gun method for detonation that used uranium was almost guaranteed to work, to the point where they felt like testing it was a waste of precious uranium-235.
And if you're the author that wrote an entire book trying to debunk the fact that there was a bombing at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you just have to understand they did test it to see if it could work. It was already there. They already knew.
You're fighting with shadows. No one knew that book existed.
I'm so true.
I don't think that author is still alive.
I don't know.
However, the implosion method using plutonium, that was far more complicated, and plutonium was easier to produce. So a full-scale test was planned to see if the Manhattan Project could go 2 for 2.
Oh, wow.
Now, the name chosen for the test, Trinity, that was a deliberate choice made by Robert Oppenheimer.
So nerdy.
It was very nerdy. It was inspired by a poem about death by World War I poet John Donne. Beautiful writer, by the way. But this poem contemplated the idea that while dying leads to death, it might also lead to resurrection. This was tied to the false hope that Manhattan Project scientists like Niels Bohr held onto in order to justify developing an atomic weapon, reasoning that nuclear weapons were so destructive that they could end all wars. Unfortunately, Niels Bohr had not been familiar with the concept of a proxy war.
I was trying to say that we should name it Gunther because that's my wife's name, but she's a fucking bitch.
Your wife's name is Gunther?
Yeah.
Well, that's a weird one.
Yeah, she's a masculine wife.
I understand why you spend so much time working in science.
Now, before the bomb was even tested, B-29 bombers were already training themselves to drop these massive 7-ton weapons on specific targets.
What do you got to train? You drop the fucking thing.
Dude, you
isn't it mostly gravity that does the work in this case?
A lot goes into it.
I really want to send you, because I truly
Kissel. Hit the button, drop the thing.
I was going to say, there was a part of me that was just like, truly, like, oh, you know, it's the same as any bombing run. They had to completely refigure the planes. They had to develop a whole delivery mechanism. They had to train because the way of dropping the style of bombs was completely different than any other type of bomb.
A pirouette? What are they up to?
Because they have to get away from it as fast as possible.
Sure.
It's how you drop it. It has to be dropped and detonated to a certain height. And also the actual payloads of it are much heavier than any other type of bomb. And then also they were talking about like the fail-safe shit. It's crazy. There's a lot of shit. Because there's a lot of stuff like, what if the bomb doesn't work? What if the bomb doesn't release? All of a sudden you're flying, you've got this thing now is now set to explode. You have this like set, like this way to like, you're supposed to disengage it. Like the implosion bomb, they said, would actually survive. They thought maybe that if it fell out of a plane and it landed and was a dud, it would be fine. And that like the center of it would hold. But the trigger one was so vulnerable that if it basically, if it fell and didn't break, it could, if it fell and didn't go off, it could break open and then just create 1,000 years of radiation poisoning in a place that exists. So they then had to, they would have to crawl inside of the gun mechanism, inside of the bomb, pull the gun mechanism out of it, and then release it, whatever's left. It's very scary.
Yeah.
Well, you just got to have someone who, you know, you got to have a little bitch.
Oh, no, and that little bitch was like, there was a guy that was that guy.
Yeah.
And he was not pleased.
No, I'm sure not.
We'll talk about him later.
All right, fantastic.
Yeah. And we, I think we did actually accidentally, like, remember there's that story of the, I guess it had to have been an implosion bomb that was accidentally dropped in, like, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That happened. I forgot about that.
Recently.
Yeah. Now, for the mission to drop the atomic bomb on Japan, the Manhattan Project tapped a 29-year-old pilot named Paul Tibbets. Tibbets had survived countless bombing missions over Germany and had a year's experience flying the relatively new B-29s. He was given a 45-minute-long briefing that explained what the bomb was just a little bit, insofar as the scientist briefing him asked Tibbets, hey, do you know what an atom is?
Atom's my brother Steve's friend.
Yeah, absolutely. I got a 45-minute training video via hip-hop lyrics when I worked at Wendy's.
Yeah, and Tippett said, yeah, I know what an atom is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the scientist said, good, that's all you need to know.
Well, no, I need to know more than that.
That's all he needs to know.
Then, supposedly, the scientist wrapped up the conversation in a particularly 1940s cinematic fashion. He said, quote,
you've got a lot of responsibility. If you use it wrong or if you fail, I can see you winding up in prison. Otherwise, you might be a hero.
Hell yeah, man. This is going to be great. I'm going to have a parade.
And so, starting in December of 1944, Tibbets began flying missions over Japan in B-29s loaded with so-called pumpkin bombs that were roughly the same size and weight of an atomic bomb. Much like the Fat Man bomb, each pumpkin bomb was about 10 feet long, 5 feet in circumference, and it weighed about 5 tons.
Man, it's a hell of a pumpkin.
I definitely would get super nervous as I'm sitting in the rolling hills of Japan, watching them drop these giant, like, obviously fake bombs, right? Like, these fake bombs are landing, and you're like, oh, that looks like a pretty big bomb. And it's like, oh, they're practicing? For what are they practicing?
Very large scale, sort of Green Goblin approach, I suppose.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah, they must have been like, what are they up to?
That's not good.
It can't be good.
Well, some of them were inert. Some, though, were filled with explosives.
Just so for
they didn't
fun.
Really, yeah, just for fun, just to see what would happen.
We're already bombing them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But the main point of a pumpkin bomb was to make sure that the pilot didn't drop a $2 billion weapon on the outskirts of the target. Or, worse, from a funding perspective, in the middle of the ocean.
Think of the funding.
Of course, you always have to. How is Epstein going to give us more money after this?
I don't know. Come on my face.
As such, 49 training missions were flown with a variety of B-29s, all with colorful names that were sometimes a bit too conspicuous.
Yeah.
You had Ooh. Strange Cargo.
Sounds like a fun movie with Humphrey Bogart.
These all sound like the super tough condoms they sell at like various, like, you know, very shady sex stores.
Yeah, the ones where like it's like a Rough Rider, and I'm like, not DMX. Yeah. I don't think I need that one.
It's like Ryu having sex with Chun-Li, but all you see is Ryu's ass, and it's weird.
Hello.
Another plane? Top Secret.
Oh, what's in that?
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Fantastic 80s spoof spy movie, though.
Yeah. You had one called Big Stink.
That is just an insult.
Yeah.
It's an insult to everyone on that fucking plane.
One called The Great Artiste.
All right. Okay. Yeah. It's interesting.
You had Necessary Evil.
Okay. Now we're getting on the fucking nose.
Yeah. All right. Exactly. What is this, a football movie?
Yeah. And most conspicuously, Up and Adam.
That's the dumbest.
I'm going to shoot you.
They know it's coming.
If you kill me, but before you have, if you do deliver a pun before you shoot me in the fucking head, I'm going to be so pissed.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the problems with dropping a big, horribly expensive bomb on Japan was that there was still one island with a very active Japanese airstrip between the American airbase of Saipan and the Japanese mainland.
I thought you were going to say one problem might be the death of all the innocent people, but no, okay.
Funding, Kissel. Think of the funding.
Think of the funding. Think of the practicalities.
I do think that we can all, that is the Pentagon. Every meeting. Think of the funding.
Oh, yeah. It's every meeting, yeah.
Well, that island where the airstrip was located, that became the site of the deadliest day in Marine Corps history. It became a byword for victory at high cost, perseverance whilst wading through the blood of your comrades, and most of all, the savagery of warfare.
War is hell. Are we getting into the sloughing now?
No, soon.
Slothering?
You wait, soon.
Okay.
That island was none other than Iwo Jima.
That's the only way you could say it, too. I found that. I've tried to say Iwo Jima.
You know what was?
In any other way, but I can't. It's History Channel voices in there. Yeah. I can't get rid of it. Because, again, if you want to get your fucking, if your grandpa is still alive, he's about 90 at this point.
Yeah.
If you want to get him going, just go two words. Iwo Jima.
One thing that was staged was that goddamn picture that went viral even before the internet.
Yeah.
Of the flag. Now, that was actually a staged picture.
Oh, yeah. They all were. They had to, because it was them winning, and then they would go and make an official winning thing.
It wasn't winning. It was like on the third day of battle. Like, they just arrived.
They did the Super Bowl shuffle. And if the Bears didn't win the Super Bowl, that would be, they would be laughing.
Yeah. It's literally, it's like, it's pre-shooting all the stuff for New Year's Eve.
They really did.
Although, while it was staged, the Johnny Cash song, The Ballad of Ira Hayes, was very real. That was about one of the guys who did raise the flag on Iwo Jima.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Ira Hayes.
Him drunken Ira Hayes, he don't answer anymore. He's a drunken
I left all my buddies Iwo Jima.
Yeah, something about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Fly from your grave.
Now, Iwo Jima was a hideous place covered in relatively soft volcanic rock.
Not to, you know, not to offend all the people in Iwo Jima.
Of course not.
Did a lot of people live there?
Very few, but some did.
It's pretty kind of farmland, I thought.
But in strategic terms, Iwo Jima was incredibly important to the Pacific theater of the war because it was dead center between Tokyo and the island of Saipan, which we talked about at the end of episode 2.
Hmm.
Saipan, you know, all the Marianas Islands, where the largest airport in the world existed at this time.
Saipan was the one where all the people jumped off the cliffs when we were coming because they thought we were going to, like, we were going to go whole hog.
Yeah.
And then that was where we would launch the Enola Gay from.
Yeah. And Tinian was the cute one that was shaped like the island of Manhattan, and they named all the streets after streets in New York City.
That's real fun.
It's really fun.
That is fun.
Iwo Jima therefore became an essential location to take if American forces wanted to stop Japanese air attacks. Not to mention the fact that Iwo Jima was a perfect base for damaged bombers and rescue missions. Now, while the Manhattan Project was not the sole reason for the Battle of Iwo Jima, the battle was certainly essential to the Manhattan Project's success. And since it is a fascinating and brutal struggle, Let's get into what the Marine Corps and the Japanese Imperial Army both went through during that long month in the winter of 1945.
We're really in Marcus's history happy place here.
This is good. I would use super glue on the tarmac. I'd glue all their planes down.
Jello.
I actually think
you're going jello, sticky. Well, you're going, I'm going slippery.
But isn't that going to cancel each other out? Now they're just able to fly again.
I don't know.
Now, the Japanese general in charge of defending Iwo Jima, Tadamichi Kurabayashi, he came from a long line of men who would all serve the emperor. But where Kurabayashi was a general, the four generations before him, and this tells you where Japan was in their history, the four generations before him had been fucking samurai.
Yeah, man.
Also, every time, Marcus, you say his name, you look up like you want an applause break. but I will say that just millions of people say that name every day.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you're still making someone extremely mad, no matter what.
Tadamichi Kurabayashi.
Kurabayashi.
Killian.
Interestingly, though, Kurabayashi had studied in the United States at Harvard as a military attaché in his youth. A lot of guys studied in America. When he wasn't at Harvard, though, Kurabayashi road-tripped across the country and took a special interest in Detroit. As a military man, Kurabayashi immediately saw that the industrial mechanisms of America could be turned into a massive, unstoppable war machine with, in his words, the push of a button.
Yeah, I don't want my weapons made at a Ford plant, fix or repair daily.
the Ford plants, that was many, 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 many of our war machines.
Yeah, fix or repair daily.
But they paid attention
not
to those.
Not because Henry Ford didn't love the Nazis, though.
That's the thing, is that he loved.
Yeah, he did. Well, in this, Kurabayashi was absolutely correct. And when he learned that his people planned to attack Pearl Harbor, he privately told his family that America was the last country in the world that Japan should fight.
And all it took was one trip to Motown. That's all he needed to do. He'd go down there because, you know what he should have brought back was a goddamn trumpet. He should have saw Motown and been like, damn it. You know what we need? You know what Japan needs?
I don't know.
Some soul.
I'm not sure if Motown was really swinging yet out there.
I think
Detroit.
So.
In the 20s?
No,
Motown was the 60s. Was the 60s.
Isn't that when scat was invented? Not the shit. Not shit in the guy's mouth. What Kim Cattrall invented.
Uh-huh.
Kim Cattrall?
You ever see the video of Kim Cattrall scatting?
Another reference to Kim Cattrall.
I'll send you that video.
Very interesting. But I was thinking the deep dish pizza, and I'm not sure if that was invented yet.
No, that's anyway. Chicago. They have Detroit-style pizza.
No, that's the Detroit style is also deep dish, but we're going to move on.
Yeah.
What this fried bottom? Fried bottom sesame. It's got to fucking.
We're going to move on.
Cornmeal bottom.
Push it moving on.
What this tells us is that some of the Japanese generals knew even before December 7th, 1941, that a war against America was unwinnable. Mm. And as it turned out, Kurabayashi would be forced to lead the defense against American invasion in one of the last major land battles of World War II.
Wow.
Now, General Kurabayashi knew that while his men could hold Iwo Jima for a time at enormous cost to the Marines, defeat both at Iwo Jima and in the war at large was inevitable. Therefore, the last thing he wrote to his wife Yoshi before he left was, "Do not plan for my return."
There we go.
Oh, wow.
That pussy's out to cave.
Yep, and then she just...
Don't worry, man. She was already cheating.
Yeah, she had a big cherry with her tongue and moved on.
But even with impossible odds, Kurabayashi was determined to make the United States pay heavily for every inch of Iwo Jima, and pay heavily we did. First, Kurabayashi emptied the island of civilians and brought in enslaved Korean laborers to turn most of the island itself into an elaborate death trap.
Wait till you see what I do with my home when I'm selling it.
I'm excited.
Over the course of 9 months, the enslaved Koreans had built a massive system of intricate tunnels, some as deep as 75 feet below ground, and all of them were wired with electricity.
Hey, Larry, what do you think what do you think happens if I step right over here? Oh!
They also
goddamn Iwo Jima. War is hell.
They also built caves, pillboxes, command posts, gun emplacements, and all of it was dug directly into the island's soft volcanic rock.
It's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I mean, it also just shows you, because we're spending billions and billions of dollars, and like, We got a shovel, a couple of pieces of feces,
hammers
and nails, and we're going to do pretty good.
They did it all with hand tools.
Yeah, it's amazing.
God damn.
Also, but they were also doing it with enslaved people.
Well, of course.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that using the enslaved people, that tends to cut down on a lot of the costs and a lot of the time and all that.
It does. Obviously. It really does. Yeah. You'd be surprised. But that's Tom Cruise. Like, it was crazy how fast he got Mission Impossible 9 going during COVID.
Brings the overhead way down.
But I think if you're in war, too, the civilians are probably fighting for free also.
Yeah. You know. Well, the civilians in this case were taken out completely. Because at this time, Korea was a Japanese, quote unquote, colony. Mm. And so a lot of them were working against their will for the Japanese.
And this is still a united Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But as such, the Japanese were able to utilize such terrifying tactics as the infamous spider traps.
These are fucking nasty.
These trapdoors were littered around the island. This is pretty much how they worked. Marine would be walking forward, forward, forward. He'd be there with all of his buddies.
And I wonder if Jane will ever write back. I wrote her about 7 months ago. We're definitely still married.
They were so romantic back then.
And he's thinking they've advanced into the island. Nothing's behind him. Everything's in front of him. All he has to worry about is what's right in front of him. When all of a sudden behind him, a fucking trapdoor opens. A Japanese sniper pops up and just starts picking off Marines.
Oh,
and then
God.
By the time they figure out what's going on, that sniper is gone and just fucking running down the tunnel to the next position. Now, as General Kurabayashi put it in a document issued to his troops, each man would make it his duty to kill 10 of the enemy before dying. And until they were all destroyed to the last man, each Japanese soldier was duty-bound to harass the enemy with guerrilla tactics. And this was actually different from how most Japanese generals handled land battles.
Mm.
A lot of them used bonsai tactics, the suicide attacks.
Yeah, where they'd like jump on them.
Yeah.
They'd, like with like grenades and shit, right?
Where they just run, like it would, you'd usually do it at night, and they would just run towards the enemy and try to kill as many as they possibly could before the enemy killed them.
Dang.
But General Kurabayashi, he thought this was futile. He thought this was a waste. He was like, bonsai, kamikaze, it's fucking stupid. Why are you doing this? It's a waste of human life. When we could just go and hide and come out and kill them with guerrilla tactics.
That's what we're trying to do. And yes, they viewed it as kind of ungentlemanly or against Bushido, right?
Yeah.
Like that a concept of like gentleman warfare. You're supposed to see the guy. You're supposed to set up a time when you arrive and fight. But they realize no, we're not going to do this. See, I'm already being tasked with an impossible thing.
Yeah.
My grandfather Herb, from the American side, he used to rail against snipers, saying that they were cowards because they did not look at the enemy in the eye. And to surprise somebody and kill them, it was considered, trashy.
I mean,
it literally is trashy.
So you're just saying it was so they were like the Snookies.
But he was in the Korean War. But
Korean War is different.
It is different.
Yeah.
You know what I'm going to go in and say? I'm really I'm pro our sniper community. And I just want to say, to both of the cameras, just want to say straight up to our sniper community, we're cool. I love what you do. Good work. Keep doing it. Stay silent.
I don't know. That's what I thought with the Chris Kyle thing, American Sniper. Yeah, he killed a bunch of people, but I mean,
it's extraordinarily difficult to be a sniper.
Yeah,
you have to be in top 10 percentile. That's very cool. And it's very helpful.
It's extremely difficult.
The weapons have gotten pretty good.
Ben Kissel is also the biggest target. Easiest target.
No, I'm not.
The three of us?
Of the three of us, absolutely.
Because I switch up my fucking ways
in
and out.
Up, down, side, right, left, flare.
Yeah, but you've got that big, you've got a much larger center of gravity. I'd be the hardest one to hit.
I think that my meat actually would, I'd catch a bullet that was less lethal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you just pretend like you're dead.
Yeah.
So a lot of, sadly.
Yeah.
Just move on.
Well, on Iwo Jima, a lot of those guys, actually a lot of the soldiers ignored the order and went bonsai anyway.
Yeah.
But regardless, considering how the Japanese Imperial Army of World War II is considered to be one of the most tenacious armies in world history, the men took Kurabayashi's directive to heart, which meant that the Marines were in for a long haul.
God damn Iwo Jima.
It's difficult to go bonsai. You got to climb up to the second rope. You got to have the guy lying there. You got to stun him first.
Oh, yeah. Hit him with the thing. You got to get the manager looking over there because you got your girlfriend. You know what I mean? Like, he's fighting with the ref. Yeah.
Yokozuna, bonsai indeed.
Yeah.
He also shat on Bret Hart's chest once.
I heard.
Or did Bret Hart shit? Either way, somebody shat.
And Yokozuna was involved.
Yeah.
You'd know.
R.I.P.
Now, at this point, I'd like to say to our combat veteran listeners, specifically our Marines, that we are going to get deep into what actually happened on Iwo Jima.
So turn up that hearing aid and really try to remember. Do you remember how you were traumatized by Saving Private Ryan? You ready to do it with cum jokes?
Yeah. I'm going to say, if you ain't up for combat today, feel free to skip ahead about 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
So at 9 a.m. on February 19th, 1945.
We need some American music. We need to come in like with that silent, like, you know, like whatever that, you know, early morning, you know, like, you know, they do in the Pacific.
Yeah.
In the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a tap slightly playing.
And I'm mighty proud of that. Ragged old.
So maybe I can give this first paragraph a little bit of a different
some
voice.
Gravitas.
At 9 a.m. on February 19th, 1945, two divisions of Marines arrived at the beaches of Iwo Jima to no resistance. In less than an hour, 9,000 men were ashore, awash in what they all described as an eerie silence.
Iwo Jima.
Wow. Now, the Marines had been told that they were going to land on a beautiful beach, no resistance. But what they found instead was a 15-foot-high slope of soft volcanic ash that slowed them down considerably.
Yeah,
because they do march.
Well, what the Japanese had done is when they dug out those tunnels, what they had dug out, they had thrown on the beaches, and that gummed up the works entirely.
Mm.
This is a big problem because the plan was for the Marines to land on a clear beach in waves, and each group was supposed to be much further inland when the next group arrived. But because of the ash, the Marines were slowed down considerably, and they got bunched up on the beach.
I mean, they really should have sent the memo out to the Japanese telling them, we're coming. Could you please not do that?
Hey, let's think about this.
More difficult for us.
Always send a text.
Mm-hmm. Always.
And once General Kurabayashi felt that there were enough Marines ashore to make it worthwhile, the shelling and machine gun fire began.
So nothing, this is easier than they said it was going to be, huh? No problems here.
That's what they thought, you know, that happened quite a bit. I mean, it also happened like in Okinawa too, where it's just, they just don't know that there is a tactic
right
being played upon them.
Yeah.
It's very smart.
Yeah. From the recesses of the caves up above, dug into the volcanic rock, Japanese machine gunners opened fire from the darkness. Marines attempted to return fire, but they only had brief muzzle flashes to ascertain the machine gunners' position. Mm. Besides that, the constant shelling of artillery made it difficult to line up a shot. Soon, the machine gunners and the artillery had filled the beach with dead bodies. And since they were bunched up in such a relatively small area, each shell blew the corpses into smaller and smaller pieces, sending them flying into the air.
Jeez,
the beach was soon littered with limbs and torsos that were continually taken out and back in by the tide. And strewn amongst the gore were dozens, if not hundreds, of Valentine's Day cards that had been delivered to the dead and dying Marines just days before.
And I actually have to say, I did get an early screener of Oppenheimer, and when they played It's Raining Men over this scene,
I thought that was so rude. That they would show.
So you're trying to bring some levity to this? This serious? You're going to bring levity to this?
But honestly, I do appreciate it, because then it segued to It's Raining Men.
It was a new version.
The rendition was much nicer.
What a bold
decision.
Rude.
Pete Davidson just shows up. He was like a magic crab or something.
He'd be great at that too.
Well, on that first day, out of the 30,000 Marines who landed, 2,420 died. As was written in the making of the atomic bomb, men tripped over 15-foot-long strings of intestines as they tried to avoid bodies that had been cut in half at the waist by machine gun fire. Due to the artillery shells, legs, arms, and heads bearing only necks lay 50 feet from the closest torso, which may or may not have been once enjoined to those limbs. But despite the gore and horror, the Marines push through.
Wow.
Godforsaken Iwo Jima.
That is so... I might just say, can we go back now?
Are we done now? You're such a good soldier. Your intestines are fighting.
Oh, my God. It really is the beginning of Suicide Squad.
And this is day one. Behind those 30,000 Marines who'd stormed the beach at Iwo Jima, a further 40,000 joined them in the following days for a brutal battle that would last well over a month, making it the bloodiest battle in Marine Corps history.
Wow.
On the second day of battle, one soldier remembered seeing a fellow Marine receive a direct hit to the face from a Japanese shell. It blew away his jaw, exposing his teeth, while also blowing open his skull. Lying atop the Marine's right ear was a ball of gray matter that used to be his brains, but incredibly, he was still alive. All the Marine could do was make motion with his right hand, asking one of his corpsmen to finish the job. And quite swiftly, one of his fellow Marines obliged the request.
And I tell you what, when I saw that, it was a lot, but now I'm fine.
You're fine?
I'm absolutely fine. Yeah, you know, one thing I have really learned from that, truly, honestly, one of the biggest things I learned from Iwo Jima, wear sunscreen.
Yeah, you're going to want some sunscreen there. If you could apply it to your brain somehow.
God, just the idea of the guy you saw.
Yeah. But you know what? Don't worry about it. In 20 years, we're going to have the microwave. You're going to love the microwave.
Actually, I think the microwave's only about like 10 years at this point.
Listen, 40, 50 years from now, you might get to see Scarlett Johansson naked and under the skin.
Just remember that.
No. By 1955, you're going to be screaming all night long and keeping your wife awake, and she's going to be terrified of you. Your children are going to be terrified of you. But guess what? Your wife is not going to have to worry about slaving over a hot oven all day long, because she's going to have a brand new invention called the microwave.
The microwave. Also, popcorn that works on the stove.
Easy life.
Jiffy Pop.
Now, by the fifth day, the Marines had come upon a
plot. That actually was that young Marine's last name.
Was Jiffy Pop?
Alexander Jiffy. That's where it came from. That's all it honored him.
Yes.
Now, by the fifth day, the Marines had come upon a plateau that was home to four defensive positions that came to be known respectively as Hill 282, Manami Village, the Amphitheater, and Turkey Knob.
Turkey Knob. Okay. Who named that one?
I'd imagine some good old boy from the mountains of Tennessee.
Nice, yeah, Turkey Knob.
He's looking for some smoked turkey. I miss it.
Okay.
These collective defenses made up the most impenetrable fortress on Iwo Jima, and it therefore came to be known as the Meat Grinder.
I don't like that. If you could send me not into that part of war.
However, the Japanese could only hold out for so long. Not only were the men on the island running out of supplies, but Japan itself had very little to give. The only resupply came when three Japanese planes tried parachuting medical supplies, food, and ammunition. All three were shot down, and only a small amount of relief fell within Japanese territory. This was the only attempt to resupply the Japanese during the Battle of Iwo Jima, because that's all they had.
All right.
The Marines, meanwhile, were not only one hell of a fighting force, but they were also blessed with, if you look at it in a relative sense, infinite supplies.
Yeah, because we had built a whole chain of supplies up to this point. It's all right there.
Yeah, when we've taken the Philippines, we're in it. Mm-hmm. We're there. And of course, that is owed to the incredible industrial power that General Kurabayashi had seen for himself decades earlier. He was seeing himself proven right. Mm. Therefore, the Marines slowly took Iwo Jima inch by inch.
Yikes.
Good Dan Carlin voice.
Yeah. Inch by inch. Now, when it came to the terrifying weapon.
Yeah. What are we talking about here, guys? What are we talking about?
Iwo Jima.
Wow.
Now, when it came to the terrifying weapons of World War II, the one that soldiers, and especially the Japanese, tended to fear most was the flamethrower.
Yeah. That makes sense. That checks out.
Yeah.
That's definitely top three.
Now, when one thinks of a flamethrower...
Have you seen the Dick Ripper?
Yikes. Yeah.
Now, when one thinks of the flamethrower, you usually have an image of a guy with a big tank on his back standing 10 feet from another soldier, letting loose a stream of drippy flame that immediately engulfs the target.
Oh, you don't want to cast me?
Yeah.
Oh, you want to cast me? Yeah, I think about it all the time.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
And indeed, some men did die like this. Hmm. A flamethrower jet burns at over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, just a hair hotter than the temperature inside a crematory.
Ooh.
While death does come relatively quick, it is preceded by instant agony and terror as the thickened fuel clings to the skin and clothes, making stop, drop, and roll a non-starter.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're so fucking dead.
Yeah. A lot of times it doesn't happen with easy access to a pool.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
It's never really like an Airbnb. You're never like hit with one like at a Vegas like resort.
Yeah. I feel like even if pool, it would, because it sticks to you.
Think of it as a flame coat.
It's a flame coat, yeah. Okay. A whole body suit.
Yeah, think of that.
Oh, man, that's horrible.
But when it came to field battle, flamethrowers weren't always great weapons, as many flamethrower operators learned on D-Day.
Oh, yeah.
They're carrying a pack of gasoline.
Yeah, I learned it from my last playthrough of Wolfenstein.
Yeah.
You just shoot it and it explodes. It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. A single bullet to a flamethrower tank usually caused the operator to explode in a ball of napalm and flame.
And he gets to go, ah!
Great stuntman work.
Yeah.
That's what these wars have provided for the past almost 100 years of cinema. Wonderful work for stuntmen.
Well, therefore, flamethrowers were mostly used in battles like Iwo Jima to clear out caves and bunkers. They weren't frontline guys.
Makes sense.
During a push at the meat grinder, for example, the entrance to a cave was first saturated with fuel, then the flamethrower was brought in to flush them out. Those who didn't asphyxiate in the cave when they tried running further in to escape the flames, those guys were set on fire, and they ran out of the cave as burning torches. According to the Marines, the flamethrowers were the only weapons that the Japanese truly feared. But the flames were only half the point. While a flamethrower does indeed produce death and destruction, you've also got to be fucking insane to use a flamethrower.
Yeah, I think so.
And that sort of psychological edge was important in battles like Iwo Jima.
Oh,
it's intimidating. It's an intimidating look.
Well, it's X factors. Yeah. What Dan Carlin brings up all the time. Those things that are a part of history that you are like, just the, no one wants to be hit with one. You know,
I don't want to be hit with one.
And as soon as the flamethrowers get broken out, everyone's like, oh, man.
Oh, shit.
We already called this place the meat grinder, which I thought was fairly unpleasant enough. And
it
would discourage people coming here.
Mm,
but apparently the flamethrowers are really going to make this sort of a hot meat grinder.
I guess. Yeah. It would. I mean, I suppose the meat grinder does make you think that there's some weapon that just grinds up human bones as you approach people. But I don't think that's really practical.
It took them a week to take the meat grinder. And they called it the meat grinder just because it was waves after they couldn't figure it out. They just couldn't figure out how to fucking. They knew they could figure it out eventually, but it took a lot of lives.
And in honor of pride, of course, make sure to go for 2-for-1s between 4 to 7 at Meat Grinder, M-E-E-T Grinder, right here in beautiful Burbank, California.
Now, after a month of fighting on Iwo Jima, almost 7,000 Marines had been killed, while almost 22,000 had been wounded.
Oof.
The Japanese, meanwhile, had lost 20,000 men. Only 216 were taken prisoner.
Wow.
And out of those 216, most were only captured because they'd been knocked unconscious and had just been found lying on the ground.
That's what I would do.
Oh, yeah, I'd be asleep.
I'd just take a bonk to the head.
You don't want me to be in any, you don't want me to have military secrets. I'm going to fold.
Yeah.
I'm going to go right to the other team.
Same
I'm
here.
Just going to
well,
go
these
run.
People didn't even have any secrets. They were slaves, so they were just told to run out there probably,
no, these
right?
These are Japanese soldiers that I'm talking about.
Oh, these
about.
Are
yeah.
soldiers
oh,
now?
Yeah, yeah. No. That's the thing. You didn't put the laborers in battle.
They were all highly trained.
Yeah, these are extraordinarily well-trained, vicious, vicious soldiers.
Mm.
Now, included in the dead was General Kurabayashi, who felt that it was his duty to die defending the island. Mm. It was thought that Kurabayashi was the only high-ranking Japanese general to die in the war while personally leading his men in battle.
Mm.
But while you may think that the high Marine death toll would make him an object of hatred, he was instead respected. And the man in charge of operations at Iwo Jima actually requested that the general's body be found so he could be given a proper burial.
Back in Iwo Jima, there were rules. Doesn't seem like there were many rules, but that seems like one.
Well, I remember that there was actually a quote, like after the second or third day, you know, with all the sand and all that, the general in charge said, "I don't know who's in charge over there, but he's one smart son of a bitch."
Wow, look at that. What a great day to chew on a stogie.
Yeah.
They were more polite than what happened in Vietnam.
No.
That's a whole thing.
That's a whole different that's a whole different can of worms.
Yep.
Yep. Back when men were men.
Yeah.
I don't know why they keep selling these cans of worms. Who's buying them?
Well, fishermen probably.
There were, however, holdouts on Iwo Jima. At least 3,000 Japanese soldiers waged a 3-month-long guerrilla campaign against the garrison force at Iwo Jima after the battle was won. And more incredible were the 2 machine gunners who held out until January of 1949.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
3.5 years after the Japanese surrender.
Well, those guys just, they hid, right? Where they were lost, and then they just kept thinking the war never ended.
Well, they didn't know, so they erred on the side of the war ain't over.
And then they killed Amelia Earhart.
That's possible. We don't know. It's not true.
Amelia Earhart arrived. I maybe seduced them all in a sort of sexy version of a Gilligan's Island kind of scenario. Yeah. But I don't know. But
I don't know.
Gilligan's Island was sexy.
She was the horniest lost woman since
the last
Virgin
one.
Mary.
Yeah,
because Virgin Mary, she never did get plugged.
Well, she did.
I think she got plugged after. Then they never talked about what happened after the Virgin Mary.
I think she cheated on Joseph.
Yeah, once she got her shit popped by the Lord. It's a long list. Trying to get up in that. Get them seconds.
Well, that's fun, though. That must have actually been a fun 3 years, thinking the war is still going on, but then there isn't a war.
I think it might have been
stressful. You still get to do all the, you know, latent homosexual acts with your buddies.
Because it's different in war.
It's different in war. Yeah. You know, you get to, you know, it's lonely.
It's raining men. Hallelujah. It's raining men.
Can't believe they put that in that movie.
Live from your grave.
Now, to this point, Iwo Jima was a bit of a microcosm of the attitudes the Japanese military had towards the war. Some, like the general, knew that it was futile to keep fighting, but did so anyway out of honor, while others fanatically kept going because they either didn't want to surrender or they didn't believe that Japan would ever do so. Mm-hmm. In other words, battles like Iwo Jima went a long way towards the necessary evil argument when it came to dropping two atomic bombs on Japan.
But well, I just got to tell you one thing, Barry. I'm having the time of my life.
I do feel like there is a little bit of that. And I also, because this is a very specific battle, but they used that. As it was, well, you know, that's the thing. Why they dropped the bomb? It's so hazy. It's a long, this historical discussion.
Yeah,
but they would use these. They would cherry pick, and because they're bringing shit to the president to kind of pitch why we need to use the bomb. And this is like one of those ways they did it. They framed this.
Number one, cool. It's cool.
It's cool. It's cool. Make a big noise.
It makes a big noise.
Well, not just that, but, you know, these battles are being shown in newsreels all across America all the time. Like, after every single battle, the newsreels come back. Everyone goes to the movie theater. They're fucking brutal. These newsreels, dude. They are absolutely brutal.
You can see here, despite the percussive events of all these bombs, these body parts are written together. And can you see, yes, Colonel Stevens, can we give him a hand?
And then what movie would play after that? I'm trying to think. 1940 cinema?
1944?
Who the fuck knows?
Like Casablanca, you know?
Actually, a newsreel before Casablanca is a great preview.
Oh, yeah. It is.
That movie is historic in some ways.
It is.
No. With Iwo Jima taken, there were no significant obstacles in the way of a steady stream of firebombers that absolutely ravaged the cities of Japan prior to the dropping of the atomic bomb.
It's almost like the firebombs were like just as bad.
Just as bad.
Yeah.
Well, almost. I'd say almost as bad because the fires went out pretty fast.
Yeah, and then it was over at least.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that sad? Are you guys talking about your marriages? Still single.
I know.
Don't,
I mean,
tell,
what?
Don't tell Jerry.
Oh, yeah. I know a couple of dogs would be pretty mad to hear that.
But while the targets were meant to mostly be industrial and military, most times residential areas were burned in the process, just as it had been in Germany. As one spokesman for the Air Force put it, the entire population of Japan was a proper military target. Yeah, no matter who it was.
Basically because of Pearl Harbor.
Because of Pearl Harbor.
Once they hit us, that's what he's basically
saying.
And
we had a lot of civilians die in Pearl Harbor.
Yes, yeah. And so we're like, they decided to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then they did that.
And they did that,
And it was bad.
It was revenge.
And it was.
So on March 10th, 1945, bombers dropped gel bombs ranging from 6 to 1,000 pounds on the residential district of Shidemachi in Tokyo, which was then home to 750,000 people.
Shidemachi, that's a lot of bombs.
That's a lot
there
of bombs.
There you go. You did it.
Shidemachi, no. Man. I can't believe.
There we go.
See, many structures in Japan at the time were built of highly flammable paper and wood. Mm. And during the firebombing of Tokyo, the wind was blowing hard enough and the buildings were burning fast enough that the fire actually got ahead of the bombers. But they dropped firebombs on the fires anyway.
They were just like, hold on, fire. This fire is really aggressive. They really want to fight today.
The description and making of the atomic bomb is harrowing.
Yeah.
About how... It's a town of fuel. and they knew it, and they dropped it on it, and they watched it form into this fucking literal, like, fire hurricane.
Like a tunnel.
That, like, it became this spire. The bombers had to lift up. They had to put oxygen masks on. Mm. The planes were getting hot.
Yeah, I would believe it.
It was fucking scary.
And the planes were 6,000 feet up, and they still had to put on oxygen masks.
Wow.
The only thing that stopped the fire after it destroyed 15.9 square miles of Tokyo was a river. And by the end of it, at least 100,000 people were burned alive. Additionally, over a million had been injured and a million were homeless. But even though they were faced with this horror, even though we knew exactly what happened and what it looked like, Air Force General Curtis LeMay, who earned such nicknames as Old Iron Pants, Bombs Away LeMay, and most chillingly, The Demon.
Well, that one's a little on the nose.
He ordered more. Hey. LeMay also did some pretty controversial stuff in Vietnam.
Hey, hello there. Hey, hello. It's me, General LeMay. Just want to say, first of all, I know we dropped a lot of firebombs already. Everybody's kind of up in arms about that.
I know that.
So I figured I could do is, you know, why not instead we'll send a wave of water and ice bombs? Funny little joke. Let's really burn it up. I actually would love to see.
We already burned it quite a bit.
Can I actually, can I go burn one? Can someone bring me a Japanese person so I can set him personally on fire? Thank
you. Seems like you have bloodlust.
No. They call me the demon for some reason.
The demon.
Well, over the next 6 days, the Air Force firebombed four more cities until they ran out of firebombs. And in all, they burned over 32 square miles of Japanese cities at the conservative estimated cost of 150,000 lives. That number, by the way, beats the lowest estimate of deaths attributed to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by about 40,000.
See?
That means that technically, to the point of pure slaughter, firebombing was more effective and less expensive than an atomic bomb.
Yay.
Well, here you go.
But in the end...
But we did with one.
That's the thing. In the end... It's all about that big mushroom cloud.
It really is.
You want to see the mushroom cloud. And you do want to see it, don't
apparently
you?
It was beautiful. We'll get into that next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've all seen it, haven't we?
We've seen some.
The mushroom cloud.
No, we've seen
mushroom clouds. There's only one picture of the mushroom cloud at a Hiroshima. Mm.
Next week, I'll go into more detail of the horrific beauty of the mushroom cloud.
Yes, indeed. I'm happy it wasn't a broccoli cloud. You ever smell one of those? Well,
let's get right into it.
Yuck. Hey, buddy, you been eating some broccoli? I'm trying not to die from diabetes.
Yeah. Like, you better if you did.
And so,
I'm part of the broccoli brigade. All right, everyone, turn around and march backwards. And fart, and fart, and fart.
And there's our general, Captain Marcus Farts.
God damn it, I'm here to win the war.
5 pounds of broccoli today, Kevin. They really fart bombed that place.
Stupid.
Yeah, well.
And so, you may be asking, while America was burning hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians alive in their homes over the course of a few days, what were the boys over at the Manhattan Project up to when it came to figuring out how to vaporize almost as many people in just an instant?
They put up a production of arsenic and old lace. That is real. And it's completely legit. They held protests. They were developing a little family. It felt like a camp atmosphere.
Yeah. Nice.
They were all working out there. A whole generation of babies were born there. And they were loose cannons. Technically, they were kind of having a lot of fun.
They were.
But it was very stressful.
Yeah.
The mushroom cloud babies.
Well, by late 1944, Richard Feynman and Otto Frisch had conducted what they called the Dragon Experiment, which proved that a chain reaction could be used to create a massive explosion in a military capacity. As a result, both types of bombs, plutonium and uranium, were on track to be completed by late summer of 1945. But on April 12th, just when the world was on the cusp of victory against Germany, President Franklin Roosevelt suffered a cerebral hemorrhage in the middle of having his portrait painted at his home in Hyde Park, New York, and he died that afternoon.
Apparently, okay, stay still.
Stay still.
Really still.
Yes.
He hasn't moved. And like, I'm done with the painting.
I'm done. He can go now.
He can leave.
Honestly, they painted him mid. Slam dunk competition. Oh. It was him versus Will Chamberlain's grandfather.
Yeah, wow.
It was kind of crazy. The air he caught, but it's they did a... have to throw.
Yeah, of course.
Air was the guy he threw.
Man, I just watched Conan the Barbarian. Wilt Chamberlain's great.
Oh yeah,
he's great.
He's always great. Always wonderful. Great. Replacing FDR was one of the most consequential figures of the 20th century when it came to setting the stage for the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And it could well be argued that had this man not been in charge, the dropping of the atomic bomb might have been handled differently.
Fuck you! I know what I was doing!
Yeah.
I don't think even he wanted it.
No, I don't.
He's such a little bitch.
No, he wanted it. He absolutely wanted it.
Because everyone thought he was weak, and he's like, "Nam is so mean."
Well, that not necessarily.
He was tiny.
He was definitely a Cartman of presidents.
Yes.
Well, instead of FDR, the man who had the power to make the decision of if, when, and how the bomb would be dropped was FDR's vice president, Harry S. Truman. Now, Truman had not been FDR's vice president throughout his 13-year run in office, and Truman had in fact been placed on the ticket during FDR's fourth run specifically because it was seen as a near certainty that FDR would die in office that term. So if you were agreeing to be a vice president, you were agreeing to be president.
You knew, you knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And isn't history repeating?
It is.
Isn't that nice?
It is.
Isn't that nice?
See, FDR's previous running mate, Henry Wallace, he had made a lot of enemies on the more conservative side of the Democratic Party because he opposed racial segregation and had a more Bernie Sanders approach to the economy.
But I mean, FDR was technically left wing, right? But he did kind of try and appeal to a bunch of people. It's very complicated, obviously. It's past me.
Well, well, Wallace was very left wing. Like, Wallace was left wing to the point where, like, he went to the Soviet Union and they showed him the gulags, but they showed him, like, a sanitized version of the gulags. Mm. Like, they were like, yes, these are all volunteers. Look at all this good work they're doing.
And the way we put it is it's like it's a home away from home.
Yeah.
You come in, you build things, you write your political screeds. Plenty of time for you to sit and think.
If I ever go to prison, I'm going to get like a... What would be the opposite of live, laugh, love?
Home is where the farts are or something like that. Yeah, that's what you need.
Home away from home.
Yeah.
Well, Wallace was great, but Wallace was also very naive when it came to the Soviet Union. And that's what people feared most. They feared that he openly favored heavy cooperation with the Soviet Union. And therefore, Wallace was replaced at the 1944 convention with Harry S. Truman against Roosevelt's wishes, which, of course, resulted in the antagonistic and confrontational policies that led to the Cold War and, arguably, the dropping of the bomb.
Harry, get over here. Okay, now, staff member, pick up my leg. Harry, bend over. Pick up my leg and kick him in the butt.
I appreciate it, Mr. President.
Now, incredibly, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, they only met once prior to FDR's death.
Wow.
And it was for like...
Who are you?
It was for like 45 minutes. It was a quick lunch.
Yeah, they could see eye to eye even while he was sitting down.
Yeah.
Well, naturally when he was sitting down.
Well, partly this was due to the fact that FDR died only 82 days into his fourth term. Basically, FDR was like, I'll get around to it eventually.
Right.
Let's meet with him. And he didn't have to campaign at all.
He was trying to end the war.
Yeah. And he's like, we'll get to Truman when we get to Truman.
Meanwhile, Truman is just out there peeping through all the paintings, just be like, when's he going to die?
When's he going to die? When am I president?
But tellingly, when FDR died and Truman contacted Eleanor Roosevelt to ask if there was anything he could do for her, Eleanor basically said, what do you mean? Is there anything you can do? You're the one who's fucked.
Yeah, man. You just got placed with a very complicated series of decisions that you're going to have to figure out how to make that might affect history.
Yeah.
Well, one nice thing about complicated decisions is boom, go big.
Boom, go big.
Isn't that easy?
The thing about, you know what I like about complicated decisions? Sometimes you just make them simple. Just going like, I don't want to. I like that one. Like, you'd be surprised about how like so many huge decisions come down to some very important person going, I like that one.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's
it.
And
that's why he wants to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's also why it was so incredibly complicated, because the decision to put Truman on the ticket was made at the Democratic Party convention. And FDR knew, like, that we almost have the bomb. Whoever is president next is going to have the bomb. But he can't tell anybody
that he's got
the bomb. He can't say that the person that comes up next is going to have an incredible fucking responsibility. So he basically
is like... He found it on day of. Like, hey, just so you know, you're president now. Yeah, I know all this type of stuff. He just died, blah, blah, blah. It's really, really intense. There's this thing called the atomic bomb. We're about to have it. pause on this. We're going to come right back to you. Harry S. Truman sitting there like, what? And they had to tell him over several days.
Well, that's the thing. Like, Truman had seen the edges of the Manhattan Project because he was chair of the Committee on Military Affairs. He had seen that there was this project that a lot of money was getting spent on. He's like, what's that thing? And they're like, yeah, don't worry about it. And
need
when
to know basis and you don't need to know.
And when he became vice president, he was told, like, hey, there's this thing called the Manhattan Project. You'll find out about it one day.
And then he did a great bit about how if it was the Queen's project, it would be like more like a Zeppelin.
And because he was president, they're all like, incredible. That's the best bit I've ever heard. Make it a shirt. Yeah. That's incredible.
That's fun, though, when the conventions before they were all a ruse. Yeah. When they would actually promote somebody new. Like, that must have been like stunning.
Yeah, it must have been fun. It must have been
when they're like, Delaware goes for Truman. And then people are like, whoa!
Yeah, when they were trying to like actually run the country.
Yeah, it was kind of fun.
But just after FDR died, same day, in fact, Truman was given the full scope of just what had been going on in the deserts of New Mexico for the last few years.
He's literally just getting done bouncing in the president's chair. Faithfully,
on the same day that FDR died, Otto Frisch had given Oppenheimer a report on the success of the Dragon experiment. So not only was Truman told of the Manhattan Project, he was told that, holy fuck, this thing actually works, so if you want to destroy an entire city with one bomb, you can.
This is the best day of my life.
That's incredible!
You can actually, they have released journal entries from Harry S. Truman, but him writing right after finding out about the Manhattan Project, and you can feel the terror that he has.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and
it's a lot of responsibility.
And holding this responsibility. It's a lot of responsibility. It was like, you can feel the terror of like, I wish I wouldn't have said yes to this. This is horrible.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Now, after it became clear that the bomb was an inevitability, the scientists at Los Alamos, Niels Bohr chief among them, tried convincing the U.S. officials that we needed to share what we knew about nuclear weapons with the Soviet Union so as to prevent a nuclear arms race and an eventual nuclear holocaust.
Boy,
wow,
yeah.
And that just, oh, wow. They all really jumped on that, yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, had Henry Wallace been president,
oh, yeah,
it's somewhat likely that this might have happened.
Yeah, all of history would be very different.
Yeah. But as it was, Bohr was waved off and told to come back later, while he and the rest of the scientists moved on to further calculations concerning how to maximize the destruction of the bomb.
Help, I've gotten my head stuck in a staircase.
God damn it, Bohr.
I just died. But take my advice. We have to share.
Yeah.
We have to share. Listen, right. If you just get some butter and put it on
the butter.
My ears.
I was going
to
suggest butter.
Yes, because I'm very firmly jammed.
You know you are.
No, basically, an atomic bomb doesn't work like a conventional bomb, as in it doesn't go boom when it hits the ground.
Because up to this point, bombs are fairly inexact science.
Yeah.
Like, you really just blew shit up.
Yeah. You just drop it, it goes, and that's
it. You got your ear burst, which is a very controversial starburst flavor.
Oh, I don't like it.
Land burst. It's all a bunch of bursts.
Well, instead of all that, the bomb had to be detonated manually. But if you detonate the bomb too soon after dropping it, it wastes its energy burning up oxygen in the sky. It's also going to blow up the plane. But you detonate it too low, and you only create a radioactive crater in the ground.
And that just really, I mean, that just makes you die in like 5 years after a whole bunch of cancer.
And you're just and you're wasting it.
Well, what you wanted for maximum wow factor was to explode it at just the right height where the energy expended has a chance to travel as far out as possible and to send the resulting shockwave as far out as possible. This both vaporizes anything organic in the immediate blast, then it destroys anything in the shockwave radius.
That and is again, the sonic boom, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's the sonic boom.
Remember, you're saying that in a scientist's cadence of how exciting this would be.
And I mean, it is crazy.
Because J. Robert Oppenheimer, for all of his, obviously his belief in human rights movements and all of the stuff that he worked on, there was this fascination.
There was a giddiness.
There was a giddiness of like, we want it to not only work, but we want it to work at its best.
Yeah, it's the people
ability
that are creating AI right now.
Yes.
They're all like, this is going to be really bad. Let's get back to work.
Let's get back to work. Well, we're not done yet.
Now, when FDR died, Germany was all but beat. So we knew we wouldn't be using the bomb on European soil. And besides that, to put it in as bluntest terms as possible, the idea of dropping the bomb on white people made everyone a little less gung-ho about using it.
Oh, yeah, man. There was definitely, that was a part of the factor for certain.
So when it came to where it would be dropped, America switched focus to the enemy that we'd spent 4 years dehumanizing completely, the Japanese, and research began to decide which city or cities might be the best target.
Well, I'm looking at you, Bugs Bunny.
But it also happened outside of the president's purview. These things were already set in motion. The Manhattan Project was just rolling. Like, no one gave a fuck. No one tried to stop anything. And so while he was like, Truman started the philosophizing of what are we going to do with the bomb after and now and blah, blah, blah. They're already choosing targets and in the most like brutal way possible.
Yeah. Now, in order for the bomb to have maximum psychological effect, General Groves wanted a city that was mostly military in nature, but had not already been bombed to shit so as to show the full destructive potential of an atomic bomb.
They wanted the show, dude.
That's nice.
Eventually, it came down to the ancient imperial city of Kyoto or the mostly industrial city of Hiroshima. Kyoto was fortunately spared at the insistence of Secretary of War Henry Stimson.
I like to vacation there during the summertime. Have you been there in the summer?
It was kind of like that.
It's actually a lot like that. He said it's a beautiful city. It's full of history. It would be a crime against humanity to destroy Kyoto.
See? Art does save lives.
And it does.
And I've been to Kyoto, and I'm Yeah.
No shit. That's right. After Australia last time.
I went to Kyoto. It's
gorgeous.
It is an incredible city. I've never seen anything like it.
You know, were they scared of you when you came? When you arrived?
It's been some time.
Okay, good.
No, not at all. Good. The people of Kyoto were actually wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to go.
I heard I'm too big.
No, they'll all be like, ride the dragon. Oh, see, look at him. He comes from the mountain.
I'm going to be held captive and be forced to perform.
So the Secretary of War, he nixes Kyoto.
Okay. Hiroshima, too pretty.
Hiroshima, on the other hand, was historically a military city. Mm. And in 1945, the 2nd General Army was stationed in Hiroshima for the defense of Western Japan. When it came to civilians, though, Hiroshima was also a center of education. Second only to Tokyo.
I mean, Americans are like, give some fuck. We blow that up.
It's a lot of students.
Oh.
Nevertheless, Hiroshima became target number one. But right around that time, just weeks after FDR died, Adolf Hitler committed suicide.
Swish, swish, quotation marks.
I've seen some pictures of a man that looks just like him in Argentina.
And with that, the Western theater of the war came to a close. Europe's done.
We did it.
Yay.
Nazis, you ain't so good anymore.
But anymore.
That's good. Wait, no, ever.
Very good. Excellent. No, that I would have not. We saw the gleam in his eyes.
You know what? Let's move on.
It's a numbers game.
It is a numbers game. Also, I wish that they would have a little plaque for his burial. It's just underneath a goddamn
It's underneath
the parking lot.
No,
they finally put.
Did they put a plaque there?
Well, it's not a plaque. It's more of an info card.
Yes, because people were going
when we were in Berlin.
They were trying not to promote the site of his dead body was, but then eventually, so many people just go. They just put up a sign.
Yeah, it's just a little info, and it shows you a diagram of the bunker.
But it's like low income housing, which has got to be extremely depressing as you just drive past me. Like the site of Hitler's suicide. Yeah. Like each day you come back with milk.
You guys were the ones in Dallas stopping traffic, pretending you were getting shot in the head like JFK.
It was kind of fun.
Oh, but right adjacent to the Hitler suicide spot is a beautiful Holocaust memorial.
It is.
It's absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, yeah, I walked that. Yeah. I walked through that.
But even though the Germans had been the impetus for the Manhattan Project, their defeat hastened the speed of the bomb's construction even more. The motivation for this was both entirely understandable and extremely human. See, the American people were quite simply done with war. While it was super cool that Hitler was dead. Don't get me wrong. That's fucking awesome.
That's cool, guys. I'm just done with this season of war.
I'm done.
I'm done with the show. Can we get a new cast?
Can we just wrap this up?
Yeah.
Please.
Well, the American people were being told over and over and over again that it was going to take no less than 1 million lives over the course of a few years to fully defeat Japan because of the tenacity displayed in places like Iwo Jima and Okinawa.
So we're already selling this to the people.
We're selling it very, very hard to the American people.
I really hope this season's final episode just has a big conclusion and we can just end it.
Mm-hmm. Just an explosive ending.
Yeah, Michael Bay-like ending.
Well, I mean, and they're selling it at both ends. You know, they're selling it in a way where, like, they've spent 4 years turning the Japanese into monsters.
Yes.
Like, absolute fucking demons. But they're also trying to hit it from a humanitarian angle of, like, well, if we bomb Japan, then we're actually going to be saving lives.
Oh, yeah. What was the thing? It's like
saving Japanese lives.
They said, do you want us to kill Japanese people or do you want American people to die? That is kind of the crux. that yeah. they put against them.
Yeah. And it was also, do you want us to kill a million Japanese people in bombing, or do you want us to kill 5 million Japanese people in hand-to-hand combat?
Right. So
you know,
let's just get it done. That's the yeah. strategy there.
I say we just get them fat.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we should have said. Cornmeal.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Sugar substitutes. Let's talk about that. High yep. glucose.
The real weapon. Syrup. The real atomic it really weapon. Is. Every, the hidden sugars in our food.
They are killing us, and there's no reason why we should eat different chocolate than they do in Europe.
No.
There's no reason why all of our candy sucks.
No, yeah. it does.
Oh, no, I'm upset with their sugar.
The European stuff is incredible. But there was also.
Thanks, Chuck fucking Grassley, who's still not dead.
But there was also another human reason to finish work on the bomb, although this one was far less emotional. The Secretary of State put it simply, we spent $2 billion on this goddamn bomb, and Congress is going to want to see a big goddamn boom.
Oh, yeah.
This is like when you show up to Disney World and it's raining and you got tickets and you're like, we're going in.
Yay!
I spent $2,500. We're going to have fucking fun. Yay. Okay, we're going to have
we're
fun.
We're smiling. Is your we're ice blowing
cream wet?
Shit up.
Your ice cream's wet? Yeah. Why don't you eat that ice cream?
Well, to that point, Robert Oppenheimer himself had interestingly come to the belief that the atomic bomb was, in his words, shit. That's he said that was an exact quote. The atomic bomb is shit because it had no military use beyond creating a very big bang that killed a lot of people all at once.
I mean, oh, yeah. Shit, maybe if the night before you eat a bunch of Taco Bell.
And here's like how this shithead who wrote the book that's saying that the Hiroshima bombings didn't happen. This is how he used that to was another reason why the bombings didn't happen. The man had devoted years of his life and his entire professional reputation to the project. How could he say it was shit? How could he doubt its military value? If he thought super weapons were shit, why sign on the project in the first place? Or if he really believed it was a super weapon that could never be used, surely a brain of his stature would grasp that even if never used, such an object would be of huge military value in the larger strategic sense of intimidation, deterrence, etc. If it were never used, so much better. But we have it directly from arguably the greatest military mind of all time, that it was shit.
All right, and that book written by Casey Anthony. Casey Anthony. I'm happy she's getting into history.
Oh, it is yeah, nice. Yeah. It is nice.
Man, she's looking thick these days. She's looking, you know, she's out there. There's some pictures stressed. Of her on Mother's Day. I'm not saying like bad.
There was pictures of her on Mother's Day?
Oh, yeah. There was some pictures of her out there.
That was a day
she
could take off.
Technically, she looks great.
Wow. Wow.
I thought, yeah. What?
It's looking good on her.
Well, really, the
Who's
only.
Who's the father? No one's ever asked that.
Who's the father?
Who the fuck is Casey Anthony's father? We'll have to get into that at some point.
I feel like that
I
was
never
answered.
Asked that question
it
once.
It was answered.
It's not
kinda.
The DJ. It anyway, I'm sorry. We'll I'm go sure. back.
Let's it was kind of sort of answered. I don't think anyone took a responsibility for it.
Yeah, for like yeah. A lot. And that's really the whole story, isn't it?
Much like the atomic bomb.
Indeed. Thank you, Henry. We're back at it.
Live from your grave.
But really, the only purpose that Robert Oppenheimer saw for the atomic bomb was to put the Russians on notice. But even though it was all but decided that America was going to use the bomb on the Japanese, the biggest debate was whether or not we were going to warn the Japanese before we used it.
Just to be polite.
Well just because it was weird. They really were like, hey, just so you know, gonna come in there.
Because they also, to that point, then they also kind of did know this is part of the performance. They call war a theater for a reason. And they're like, this is going to be a big message to them, to the world.
Well, most of the Manhattan Project scientists and even some in government thought it was only fair and most of all, humane to warn the Japanese that we were in possession of a weapon of incredible power that we would definitely use if they didn't surrender. But from a military perspective, it was decided that the Japanese would not be informed of a kill shot bomb. Because if we made a big stink about this new weapon and it ended up being a dud, it would weaken our military position worldwide.
It's about our rep.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
But what was most important here was that it was known that the Soviets were also working on an atomic weapon. It was estimated, however, that they were at least 7 years behind America, possibly as many as 10. So dropping the bomb would show the Soviets that while their dick was ragged and raw from years of warfare against the Germans, our dick was rock hard, disturbingly veiny, and massive. Militarily speaking.
I mean, I do have that survey. Our penises are 5.4 inches on average, which is 60th out of the 90 nations that they studied.
This is militarily.
We still beat the British.
This is about mental penises.
I mean, there's a reason all missiles look like big dicks.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's because that's how they fly correctly
just,
through the air.
Yeah, that's just the best way to fly. If they were to fly best as vaginas, they would be shaped like vaginas.
Man, that would be cool.
We call this one the Brett Favre. It goes slightly to the left.
What do you think Hillary Clinton would have done? If she was president.
Yeah, she would have killed people with the vagina bombs.
So,
that's only fair. Women can kill too.
Yeah. We put the uranium in this upper area. I don't know what this is. This upper area under this hood, the little bump of uranium.
It's an episode of South Park, actually.
Wow.
Put a bomb in her pussy.
Nice. Well, as such, by June 1st, even before the first atomic bomb test was completed, Truman decided that the atomic bomb would be dropped on Japan, and he would soon take steps to ensure that the Japanese would, quote-unquote, make him do it.
He finished his peas, and then he was like, let me out of this high chair. I got a decision to make.
Let me out of this cage!
Let me out of here.
Now, when it came to testing the world's first atomic bomb, most accounts make it seem like Trinity was tested right outside of Los Alamos. But the actual site was 240 miles away in New Mexico's Jornada del Muerto Valley.
Ooh.
Yeah. Death's Passage.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Now, initially, Oppenheimer set the test for July 4th, 1945.
He loves a moment.
He does. Didn't end up happening that. But when Oppenheimer's brother Frank showed up to help in May, he found hundreds of people furiously setting up an intricate testing site to detonate the bomb, all while the plutonium was en route from Hanford site in Washington State. Now, perhaps to add some levity to a deadly serious endeavor, senior scientists placed bets on how powerful the atomic blast was going to be. Because truthfully, none of them had a firm idea of how big the boom was going to be.
Yeah, they did not know. They really didn't. They tested other versions of it, of like bombs. They tried to build huge, huge bombs. Mm-hmm. And tried to kind of see like, what's the biggest explosion we can make? And they did that. And they're like, okay, so what if that's like 1,000 times like that? And then they try to like conjecture.
Yeah,
because this like also this invented a whole field of explosive radius tests and all this kind of shit.
It's like when you got a really great bit and you're like, this is going to crush, but then you do it and it doesn't work.
Yeah, people get all mad.
Because you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know. Or you do it and it does very, very well. And next thing you know, you're Larry the Cable Guy.
And that's it.
And now you're forced to be this guy who says, get her done all the time.
It's really strange.
In reality, he was a vegan when he started
never
that
really
character.
He never converted to Larry the Streamer Guy.
Nope, he never did.
Interesting.
He never did, but he was a vegan before he created that character.
Oh, I
he created
know.
That character.
It's
and
a fake.
Now he eats a bunch of meat.
It's kayfabe, baby.
Wow.
Oh, kayfabe.
Well, one scientist picked the equivalent of 45,000 tons of TNT.
Mm-hmm.
Another picked 8,000. Robert Oppenheimer, he went Price is Right style. He said 300.
He didn't say one?
One.
One technician went even further, saying that Trinity was going to be a dud. Fuck you, it's not going to work.
Oh, wow.
Just be like, I don't need this shit. Right now, can't you see? I'm already rail thin. I've been crying over my communist girlfriend. She's
sad. Well, technically, that is the Price is Right. He went and done.
Oh,
so that's
low.
The one. Yeah. He's going low.
But you can't bet zero, though.
You can't bet zero.
You got to bet at least one.
Well, I would say one would be equivalent to a dud.
Oh, yeah.
No. Yes.
Now, one would be equivalent to a ton of TNT. That's still quite a large explosion.
Yeah, but not by... But
not enough.
It's not on the cover of Time magazine.
No.
No.
But when it came to placing bets, Enrico Fermi was apparently in a playful mood that day.
I make a joke.
In full earshot of guards and military personnel who barely knew what was going on, he started saying that he wanted a bet on whether or not the atmosphere itself was going to be ignited by the bomb.
Hey, come on.
And if it did, would it just destroy New Mexico or the entire planet?
And think about it. And how mad is the moon going to be when it gets to shine? It cannot show. Or what is it like to be a pizza pie?
I really wish you didn't dress like Pinocchio during that.
Now, this little anecdote has been twisted over the years to mean that the Manhattan Project scientists didn't know whether or not the Trinity test was going to light the entire world on fire. But that's not true. The calculations have been done long before the Trinity test that showed that this doomsday scenario was effectively impossible. But the fact that they even had to do the calculations in the first place is indeed incredibly frightening.
It's kind of fun to think about. It's kind of fun to think about.
Now, when it came to who was most frightened by the success of the test, none at the site was more nervous than test leader Ken Bainbridge. He knew that if the bomb didn't go off, or worse, if it hang-fired, it would be his responsibility to drive out to the bomb by himself to see what had gone wrong.
I elect
Ken.
All right, guys, who's coming with me?
Last hand up. You guys got to go.
Oh, God damn.
Sorry, Ken.
Now, Oppenheimer, meanwhile, was nervous as well, because after all, this whole thing had been his baby. In the weeks leading up to the test, he'd been reading verses from a Hindu scripture called the Bhagavad Gita, which Oppenheimer had been using since college as a sort of calm down text.
I've never been able to say that word. Bhagavad Gita. It's a very important book, though.
Yeah. But once the kinks were worked out with the bomb and it seemed as if all was well, Oppenheimer's demeanor changed. There was a small delay because of weather, but when General Groves asked Oppenheimer if the weather was going to hold out for the Trinity test, Oppenheimer said, quote,
"The weather is whimsical."
No, it's not whimsical. The weather is fucking brutal.
It's like rabbits.
Whimsical.
No, it's
no, the
perfect
dust
time.
Storms that happened in Texas. Whimsical.
I had a little creature told me to go and kiss my girlfriend.
It's time.
Oppenheimer.
It's time.
You know, there's going to be a movie about you.
Really? Yeah. I hope it's a musical.
And so, at dawn on July 16th, 1945, all the top scientists of the Manhattan Project, plus a select group of 10 guests.
Oh.
Yeah, very select guest list.
The chuckle. I'm just here for the shrimp.
They huddled in trenches that were anywhere between 5 and 20 miles from ground zero. The Trinity bomb, still known as the Gadget, was sitting atop a tower to maximize the blast radius. Then, at 5:25 a.m., the countdown started. All present were told to lie down on the desert sand and turn their faces away while burying their heads in their arms.
Yeah, head down, ass up.
That's
like how
the
you're
way
supposed
I like
to take
bomb.
That bomb. Yeah.
Some really complied, but most didn't. Some just put on sunscreen.
Did they not have they not read the parable of Sodom and Gomorrah? Mm.
Richard Feynman just sat behind a fucking windshield.
That is funny.
Yeah, he's crazy.
He's crazy. Yeah, he didn't care.
Finally, though, at five...
Is this one guy going to light a cigarette on it?
Yeah, it's going to be fun as hell. Then he's just a flaming skeleton. Be like, my calculations were off.
And the cigarette didn't light?
Finally, though, at 5:30 a.m. exactly, the first atomic bomb in history ignited.
Yes!
How am I supposed to feel I was again here just for the shrimp?
A physicist present said that he saw an enormous flash of light, the brightest that he or anyone in history had ever seen. Mm. He said that it was a vision that was seen with more than the eye. It seemed to last forever to the point where you wished it would stop. And you know how long that flash lasted? 2 seconds.
It was burned into his brain.
It's pure energy.
Yeah, but it was soon followed by an enormous ball of fire that rolled as it grew up into the air in menacing yellow, scarlet, and green flashes. The physicist said that he felt as if a new thing had been born, a new control which man had acquired over nature.
Meanwhile, one guy's like, where are the hot dogs?
Yeah, where are the hot dogs?
Can I eat these? Can I eat these shrimps?
Are you still fresh? Nature still wins.
Yeah, nature did win.
I will take nature in general over anything that humans can create.
Because within it, radiation is kind of natural. Like, right. I was reading about, like, with the building of polonium and stuff, like, all this kind of stuff, where they're like, they pull this stuff out. Like, technically, that poison, we just kind of released it.
Yeah. And then nature's like, thank you, I'm going to add this to the arsenal when we have our next tornadoes that roll through Kansas.
Yes.
Frank Oppenheimer described the cloud as brilliant purple. That was, of course, because it was glowing with radiation. And the thunder from the blast seemed to eternally echo through the canyon where the bomb was detonated. Now, the legend is that upon the detonation of the bomb, Robert Oppenheimer cinematically uttered a chilling line from the Bhagavad Gita. But that's not exactly what happened. Oppenheimer later recalled that when the blast passed, he and the others solemnly walked out of their shelter into a changed world. Some people laughed, some people cried, but most were silent. As for Oppenheimer himself, he said he remembered a line from the Bhagavad Gita, in which the Hindu god Vishnu is trying to persuade a prince that he should do his duty. To make the argument, Vishnu takes on their multi-armed form and utters the line that has become so famous in the decades since. Now, I am become death.
the destroyer of worlds.
It's fucking cool. It's the darkest and fucking most intense a nerd's ever been.
It's cool. It is cool.
But
it's
he
cool.
just thought that.
He just thought that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's the same as saying it.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait to, like, I can't wait to be in hospice and doing the thing in my mind thinking I'm going to say, either those drapes go or I do. And then you die. But I know my my last words are just going to be like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Oh, it hurts. I'm fucking shitting.
No, but you need to be able to change your drapes. It's your room. You pay a lot of money for that room. But please, when the nurse comes in, put your pants on. We've got a lot of complaints, Henry.
You call me David Copperfield.
Well, as Oppenheimer put it, all those present at the Trinity test thought something like the I am become death in one way or another.
Sure. It sounds like they did. So, yeah.
Heavy situation.
Right.
As far as what he actually said, from what Oppenheimer's brother remembered, Oppenheimer's first words were he just said, it worked.
It works.
It works.
That's it.
That was good.
However, while Oppenheimer painted himself as a solemn individual contemplating his place in human history, a physicist named Isidore Rabi remembered that when Oppenheimer returned to the Los Alamos lab, he was strutting around like it was the end of high noon.
Yeah, somebody's the big swinging dick in this fucking room. Yep, started his math, then it went boom. And who did it? Old Oppie and his big swinging fucking dog. So all y'all, go fuck yourself. I'm going to go read some Marx.
I mean, he did. It would be a moment of pride, I suppose.
As far as who won the bet, though, the blast was actually four times larger than what they thought it would be.
Oh, so whoever bet the highest actually also bet the lowest. Price is Right rules. That's they still
right. won. Yeah. Trinity turned the desert sand into a light green reflective glass that they ended up calling Trinitite. If you look up a picture of Trinitite, it looks like if scabs were made of boogers.
It's cool looking.
If scabs, what? Marcus, you're gross.
It's what it looks
it
like.
If scabs were made of boogers.
If scabs are made out of boogers.
That's gross.
Well, as far as the damage done goes, Trinity eviscerated jackrabbits 800 yards away, tore the doors loose from a farmhouse 3 miles away, caused temporary blindness 9 miles away, and it caused severe damage to eyeballs 5 miles away. At 1,000 yards, pine boards set up to test destructive power were completely charred. And at even 1,500 yards, exposed surfaces heated almost instantly to 750 degrees Fahrenheit.
Ooh.
In other words, the scientists knew exactly what dropping an atomic bomb in the middle of a city was going to do immediately.
It's going to lead to a victory.
As far as how much they knew or how much they allowed themselves to know about what would happen a week, a month, a year, or a decade later, that's a little harder to suss out.
But as Robert Oppenheimer says, it was not his job.
Yep.
That was not his job. His job was to make the bomb and deliver the bomb.
Yeah. But nevertheless, once the Trinity test was a success, a 15-foot crate containing most of the little boy bomb assembly was loaded onto the ill-fated USS Indianapolis on its way to Tinian Island.
Oh, no. It's a ghost ship, my friend.
Oh, my God. It's like a fucking cameo from another series. Yeah. It's like when Steve Urkel was on Step by Step.
I remember that.
Yeah, for new listeners, you can find the full story of that harrowing tale in our archives as to what happened to the USS Indianapolis after they dropped Little Bomb off at the island of Tinian. They fucking brought the they brought the fucking uranium in a lead bucket.
Yep.
I guess.
That's where it goes. Yeah.
Now, on the same day of the Trinity test, Harry Truman was present at another fateful event. He, Churchill, and Stalin were attending the Potsdam Conference to decide what was to be done with Germany now that the war in Europe was over.
Do we tickle them? Should we just tickle her feet?
I was thinking about, I just want to take pictures of all their feet, obviously. First
Of course.
And obviously. Then I want to see, I want to see him pull taffy.
Better idea. Why don't we just give them bunches and bunches of money so they can kind of rebuild?
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to.
Perfect.
Yeah. It was called the Marshall Plan.
what a way to punish somebody for trying to take over the world.
Well, actually, if you want to know more about all that, our next series in No Dogs in Space is going to go way into what happened to Germany after the war and the Marshall Plan and all that shit and how it essentially created electronic
music.
We're
just going to eventually completely cover every decade. Going to eventually grow.
The network as a whole. By the time we're done with this shit, we will have covered the entirety of human history.
Yeah, I think so.
At the very least, we'll have covered the entirety of the 20th century. But for the purposes of this story, Potsdam was also a meeting to decide how the Allies were going to finish off Japan.
Now, by this point in the war, Japan was standing alone. Italy had long since been finished off, and Hitler's corpse was either ashes in a ditch or secreted away to some Soviet meat locker.
Certainly not in Uruguay.
Argentina.
But either way, Japan had no allies. And to put it simply, everyone around them, they were pretty pissed off.
Yeah, I think everyone was frustrated. Mad.
China was a little miffed about the whole rape of Nanking thing. Everything that went along with it. Korea hadn't been too happy about all that enslavement business.
Hey, that's some of the worst business you can get involved in outside of the restaurant business. Yeah. Extremely vulnerable.
Well, oftentimes they go hand in hand.
Russia was ready to invade along with America. And since Japan had been the aggressors in this war, they had no moral standing internationally. No one was helping out Japan. That's not to mention the fact that Japan's Navy and Air Force was relatively non-existent. And even if they did have ships and planes, they didn't have any oil or gas to put in the ships and planes.
You're going to want that.
And that's also not to mention the fact that the actual people of Japan were rapidly starving to death.
Now, this may sound like an extremely insensitive thing to say, but...
Why you pointed to me?
They're perfect for an atomic bomb because they can't defend themselves. So it's like it is this... It's like that is the most brutal... fucked up way you can look at it, where like not only do we get to flex to the world what we can do and what we've created, but also they can't fuck it up on our way to go do it.
No.
They're sitting there waiting for it. You've been playing a lot of Civ 6.
Oh yeah.
When you finally get to the atomic era in Civ 6, and you really do, because then that's what I do. I save it. I always kind of I've destroyed a bunch of other countries around me.
Sure.
And I always kind of know that there's a smaller country that I need to go wipe out on my way to a domination victory.
Yeah.
And by that point, I'm leagues ahead of them. Like it kind of various. And then you really like, and I feel myself. I remember getting a little snack and I repour my drink. I put the atomic weapon on the plane. Mm-hmm. I fly it over.
It's really
fun. It's
really
like a fun
classy
afternoon, you know?
Yeah, really. It's really fun. What I like to do is play Civ 6 as the Japanese and then have them drop the atomic bomb.
Oh, yeah. It's much better to do it. Like, it's fun to change things.
Yeah, it is.
It was a very racist policy.
Oh, yeah. It's not good.
It's very racist.
It's awful. It's awful. Yeah. It's one of the worst crimes of humankind.
Yeah. Additionally, contrary to popular belief, Secretary of War Henry Stimson knew that Japan was not a country of mad fanatics willing to fight to the last man, woman, and child. He openly said that they were an extremely intelligent people whose transition from an isolated country to a world power in just a few decades had been astonishing, even if that transition had been at times horrifically bloody and brutal. Therefore, Stimson concluded that when it came to surrender terms, America should first warn Japan that a horrific bomb attack, worse than even the firebombing of Tokyo, was in the cards if they chose not to surrender. But if they did surrender, Stimson suggested very strongly they should be given the option of keeping a constitutional monarchy, much like England.
Now, this was going to be an issue, especially with Harry S. Truman. Yes.
Now, this was the basic equivalent of an unconditional surrender, because at the end of the day, who really gives a shit if the emperor is, quote unquote, in charge? Does it really fucking matter if Queen Elizabeth is in charge or if King Charles is in charge? Nothing changed.
No, the only person I want is the Charles in charge from television.
Scott Baio, controversial figure.
Controversial figure.
Problematic man.
I haven't thought about him in a long time.
But in the end, it's really all symbolic. And that went double for the Japanese. Therefore, it shouldn't have been a problem to keep a constitutional monarchy. It shouldn't have mattered. And the Soviet Union was ready to mediate a deal between the Japanese and the Americans.
You know things are bad when the Soviets are like, let's calm down, guys.
Let's
come on,
God.
The rational
let's
voice here.
Yeah, and there were people within the Japanese government that were absolutely ready to go. The emperor was ready to go. But as I said earlier, Truman and the rest of his future Cold Warriors wanted to force Japan's hand, and they knew just how to do it. They played harshly on the Japanese concept of honor by demanding a completely unconditional surrender, basically telling the Japanese to sniff our butts and like it.
Sometimes you do, but most of the times you don't. And these guys, because
ironically enough, I think that's the number one game show in Japan right now. sniff our butts and like it. They have a funny relationship with butts.
They really do. I love butts. And so.
They love sniffing.
There's a lot of Japanese game shows, clips that I've seen, that have a lot to do with smells. A
lot of smells.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have those shows without us.
Oh, yeah, thankfully. That's the one good thing about the atomic bomb. He said that basically, maybe I might be wrong, but I feel like Truman was trying to say,
part of this unconditional surrender is that your people have to vote for a new leadership. That basically we're getting rid of the imperial family.
They're spreading freedom, democracy. Quote, unquote,
yes, which is, again, this the beginnings of this idea of we're going to go and just replace your government as something, even if it hurts you, as long as it's pro-us, that's kind of what we get to do because we made the atomic bomb.
Well, at the very base level of it, like what they did, the Japanese could not stand, what they couldn't say yes to was an unconditional surrender. They yes. needed something.
They needed
like,
something. They needed like something.
They needed a shred of something to retain like a shred dignity. Of honor, yes. a yeah. little bit of dignity that they need. And Truman knew.
No, he wanted to push
him. Yeah, he knew that if like we give an unconditional surrender, they're going to say no matter what.
They wanted to drop the bomb.
They wanted to drop the bomb yes. and they knew this is how they did it. Yes. That this is how they could
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, that's what you said. They made him make him do it.
Yeah. And the declaration said the alternative to surrender was prompt and utter destruction. But they did not say what prompt and utter destruction meant.
Yeah, is that like figuratively? Like you're going to read me to filth? Like are you going to get one star my podcast so it drops?
That's horrible to do that.
Now the Japanese rejected the terms of complete unconditional surrender just like everyone knew they would. And the American government therefore pretended like they didn't have any other choice but to drop the bomb.
You've tied my hands.
Yep, it's like when you sign up for fucking EA, man. You know, goddamn.
I mean, love SiriusXM, but they've been calling me and fucking calling.
Have they
call,
really?
They call oh, me they so call. Much. They call
SiriusXM does?
They call yeah. all the time.
It's very similar.
It's weird.
As the Americans put it, they were actually saving Japanese lives because the military were training every able-bodied person on the mainland to fight with sharpened bamboo sticks to the death if an American land invasion came.
And this is where we inspired them to do a Toyota-thon. The idea is that we just say, yes. you know what I mean? You expand the prices right before, but then you cut them right before. Totally. You see you're saving.
Very good.
And the thing is, they were training the people to do this, but it was more propaganda. It was yeah. more morale. There are videos of, I mean, you know, a bunch of women and children with these sharpened bamboo sticks going through the motions.
It's comical.
Yeah, and it's all yeah. shot in I mean, Los Angeles.
Yes, it is very real. But given the U.S. artillery,
they were defending
it was
themselves.
Not a, yes. It I was mean, not comparable.
I mean, I'm willing to bet that while some would have fought, but let's also not like pretend like the Japanese are the good guys here.
No, they yeah. did fucked up shit. Everybody,
the Japanese did some really fucking
It's World War II.
It's World War II. Yeah. Yeah. It's World War II. No one got out clean.
Yeah.
No one.
But at the end of the day, I'm willing to bet that while some of these people on the Japanese mainland would have fought to the death, it probably would have been closer to what the Germans got when they called up the Volkssturm. The people's militia. A few people are going to show up, but not a lot.
No, it's going to be certain old people and children. Yeah. And it's like, it's not, it's actually really fucked up for then our soldiers to go and shoot all of these, like, people. Like, these are, none of them are
with
trained.
With any luck, you'll find a wife and a family.
Well, it's certainly not enough to justify the horror show that was to come.
No.
But through propaganda and self-justification, America gave the go-ahead to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Now, the Air Force knew that the Manhattan Project wasn't going to be a secret after the bomb was dropped. So,
yeah. yeah.
So General Groves actually invited photographers and journalists to the island of Tinian to record the takeoff for Prosperity. The guys boarding the Enola Gay felt like celebrities. Flashbulbs are going off. Wow, they're saluting. Dude. They're smiling.
Because they're literally saying, it's like this thing of like, aren't we all happy what we've all figured out? Like
great.
This bomb, because they all knew everything was going to be different. The second the bomb
of
goes
course.
Off.
Of course. Yeah.
And so after making their way through a crowd of reporters and photographers, the bomb crew boarded the Enola Gay, which had been named after the pilot's mother. Her name was Enola Gay.
I would thank you for clarifying.
Her name was Enola Gay.
And Gay was the bar she went to.
There you go.
Along with the crew, though, were three scientists who had the task of assembling the last bits of the bomb on the way to Hiroshima because they didn't want to assemble the thing on the island.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's big, explodes.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the only people on board who knew they were dropping an atomic bomb were the pilot and the three technicians. In fact, one of the technicians had a handgun in case of capture, so he and the others could check themselves out to keep the Manhattan Project secrets out of enemy hands.
I mean, I fly with a gun every single time, just in case.
He does. He does. And they're like, and they'd be surprised. They'll thank you. They're like, thank you
weird.
For doing this.
Yeah.
See, I would have done it with my fingers crossed. I'm like, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll do that.
And so at 3 a.m., two of the nuclear technicians radioed Tinian Tower and said, "Judge going to work." That signaled that the assembly of the bomb was underway in the bomb bay, thousands of feet above the Pacific Ocean. It took 11 steps to assemble the bomb. But as one technician put it, only a suicidal maniac would have made the assembly dangerous. That being said, that same technician was indeed handling explosive gunpowder right next to a nuclear weapon.
Well, if you can survive.
Because you remember, this bomb's brand new.
Yeah.
So they are just assembling it all together for the very first time on its way to go drop it.
And if you can get through that with your partner, maybe you guys have a chance.
You can just even.
Maybe
honestly,
you have a chance.
Natalie and I were talking. We went through a dip and we were like, you know, like, what? How do we come together?
Did IKEA
and
furniture.
What we did was that we just put together this sample atomic bomb in our home. And it's really, honestly, it's incredible the bonding.
Rough patch over.
Rough patch over. Done. And our neighbors are afraid.
That's great.
And
now,
it's when we've just been fucking right on their front lawns.
Well,
and
good.
Just showing them because I was like, you could stiff my butt and you can like it.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Well, by 6 a.m., the Enola Gay flew over Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima.
And was joined from that airfield by two more aircraft who are working as observation and instrument readers.
That's mean their calculations.
An hour and a half later, little boy was armed. Tibbetts climbed to bomb altitude and leveled off at 32,700 feet, going only by sight because none of them were allowed to bring maps. Once at bombing height, the technician told Tibbetts that the bomb was in order, and 5 minutes later, Hiroshima came into sight. At 9:15 a.m., the bomb bay doors opened and little boy dropped. And as Tibbetts bolted the Enola Gay upward, he had one thought. Now it is in the lap of the gods.
Well, and that's in, where we'll pick back up.
For
part five of our series on the Manhattan Project.
Wow. Well, you know, God, if he was out there, could have like grabbed it.
That's not Chicago night.
Right.
You can really, man. Woo! It is just a fucking. I can't believe we're here. Next week, we're gonna get to the day of Hiroshima, Nagasaki. What kind of happened afterwards? And we're gonna put this. We're putting this. We're shipping out.
Yeah.
This is the end of the Manhattan Project next week. I can't believe how far we come.
Maybe. Maybe the end.
Oh, God.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's just do.
We're just going to have to see.
Marcus, I can't.
He wants to get into shovels.
I've just been reading so much.
Because now, after the bomb, then they're going to have to shovel.
But that's the thing, Henry. You can move on from the bomb itself. Oppenheimer's done, man. He's out of the picture. His story's over with. Now, you can get to the sloughing.
I know.
Now, you can be.
I think we can just end it after that.
Now sloughing magazine is so hard to find.
Well, yeah. I mean, and now you can take pictures of those sloths without their consent.
Now you can get to the big dripping black dog that the kids thought was a dog, but it was really their mom.
Now you can get
to the people melting as they were falling into the river. Now you can get into the goopy river.
Finally, for my pool reading.
You can get into what is quite possibly the most horrific week that mankind has ever witnessed. It's gonna get fucking rough, people.
Hey man, were you there when James Corden got his show?
That was almost as bad.
Yeah, well, talk about a bomb.
Talk about a fat boy.
Guys.
Was it Long Boy?
Check me out.
Fat kid?
It's Fat Man and Little Boy.
He's another one who has the same little boy legs, fat man top.
You imagine? That's the thing. If you're a little overweight, you cannot be rude to waitstaff.
You really can't.
You really
cannot be.
Especially not about
eggs. Skinny, but especially.
I want to make a little bit of an announcement. I am going to be doing a live show. I believe I'm allowed to announce this. I'm doing it anyway because they haven't, but it's coming up. Dad's Garage in Atlanta. I will be there July 7th through the 9th. I will be headlining, doing some improv shit. Come check it out. Go just ask them where the fucking tickets are. I'm going to put up a link on my socials very soon. I'm very excited to do those shows. I know Kissel's going out and he's going to go and
well,
show yourself.
Well, I'm selling
yourself.
Tickets now, so
you're
I've got to go
these
do
goddamn
this.
Tickets.
So
you sell the fucking tickets.
July 9th in San Diego, July 16th in San Francisco, July 23rd in Las Vegas for my birthday weekend, which I don't usually celebrate, but perhaps I will then.
You're in Vegas.
And then July 30th, Ontario, California.
Yeah, we can't wait, man. Can't wait to do some bullshit.
Come on out.
And
then we're going to be doing, and then Henry and I are going to be going to do something as well.
Yeah, we got
that
we
will tell you about in the future.
We got to get that going. We're going to get that going. But guys, wow. Good work.
No, thank you.
Great job, Marcus.
Same for all.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thank you all so much for listening. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Aggie.
Magustalations.
Hail me.
Never drop another bomb. No need to drop another bomb.
No, drop a bomb.
No, man. Instead of dropping bombs, you need to drop sandwiches. We can drop love. We can drop hugs.
Oh, drop hugs. I
good.
Like that.
Hug patrols coming through.
It's the worst. It's always just
they were
going
to bomb you, but instead we've come to hug.
Just bomb me.
Drop some turds. Stay regular.
Yeah.
Oh.
Take a shit instead.
That's a good call.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors. You can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.